the same way it worked in old Israel. They started out with a real simple set of laws. And then the traditions grew up around them. And then there were those who were the interpreters of the laws and the traditions. We're going to be talking about Wow, how did that particular title slide get in there? God is awesome. Wasn't in there earlier. God's incredible book. That is where we are. Oh, the kids can leave now. In fact, please do. Have we started the tape yet? Because this hasn't gone too well so far. Oh, good. As a real player file or whatever it is, real audio. God's incredible book. We started talking about this yesterday, and just a quick reminder, we talked a little bit about inspiration, and we started talking about ancient texts and looking at some of the evidence for the Greek New Testament. We are going to be talking about archaeology, but we actually aren't done with ancient texts yet, and we will be talking a little bit about science and prophecy as the final subjects that we'll address in thinking about God's incredible book, the book that reveals the mind of God. And as I hope that we will all already believe, and certainly be more convinced of before we're done, reveals it quite accurately and quite reliably, that we can really count on the Scriptures. God's Word, ancient texts. This is a picture of an Isaiah scroll written in Hebrew. What we really talked about yesterday, though, was Greek texts, and we really didn't talk about the Old Testament in Greek. We talked about the New Testament in Greek. I do just want to make a comment or two about the Old Testament in Greek. The Old Testament was written as we have it in terms of the law of Moses and up through the final books of the Old Testament, which would be Ezra, Nehemiah, and Malachi of the prophets, but Ezra, Nehemiah really being the final closing portion of the Old Testament. The Old Testament was written between about the 15th century B.C. and the 4th or 5th century, rather, 5th century B.C., between about the 15th and 5th centuries B.C. The Old Testament was translated into the Greek language in about 250 B.C. We don't know the exact date, but roughly the middle of the 3rd century B.C. It was a project that was probably undertaken in Alexandria, Egypt, although we don't know that with certainty either, but probably in Alexandria, Egypt. The Greek translation of the Old Testament is called the Septuagint, based on the idea that there were 70 scholars who engaged in the work of translating the Bible from Hebrew into Greek. Now, the Old Testament in Greek is actually a very important kind of witness to the authenticity and accuracy of the text. When we talked about the Greek text yesterday and just had a few brief comments toward the end of the class time on the Codex Sinaiticus that was found in the mid-1800s that came from a monastery on the modern Mount Sinai, that same volume that had the complete New Testament in it had a lot of the Old Testament, although a portion of it had been destroyed, had been used as fire-starting material. Some of the Old Testament in Greek there had been destroyed, but some of it was still intact. And so that is pretty much the oldest copy of the Greek Old Testament that we have available, as well as the oldest copy of the Greek New Testament that we have available. But what I want to focus on today for the remainder of our time is the Hebrew text, the original language of the Old Testament, and we're going to talk about it in terms of the Masoretic text, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And tomorrow, or rather day after tomorrow, when we have another class, we'll talk about some other inscriptional evidence, and we'll talk about some other testimony besides inscriptions. The Hebrew text, as we know it, is based for the most part on what is called the Masoretic text. Now, that's named after a group of Jewish scholars. When you see that word Masoretic up there, it's drawn from a Hebrew word Masora, M-A-S-O-R-A, and that word means rules, basically. And that name comes from the fact that the scribes who were responsible for transcribing, for copying the scriptures year by year and generation by generation, came up with a very stringent set of rules which they had to follow in making copies of the scriptures. You may remember on that Isaiah scroll that was up there, if you were in here yesterday, that I pointed out where a line had been crossed out and a correction had been written above the line, where one scribe, in his copying, had made a mistake and another scribe had corrected it. And you can tell it was another scribe because the handwriting is different. So one scribe made a mistake, another scribe corrected his error by crossing it out and writing in the correction above the line. When you're dealing with the Masoretic text, of which there's an example in the picture here, when you're dealing with the Masoretic text, that's not acceptable according to the rules. You cannot have a line crossed out and a correction written above it. If you mangle a line of text in copying the Masoretic text, you've got to throw away the whole page. Now, that would have been more difficult when you were dealing with the scrolls, because by the time we come to the Masoretic text, the technology is changing a little bit, and we are having books that are sewn together, codices. We are having books that are made out of pages sewn together, pages folded into quartos, into groups of pages similar to what we have now, and then sewn together into bound volumes. And so it becomes a little bit more practical in a sense. You don't have to take a knife and cut a section out of the scroll and take a new skin and sew it into the scroll and do all those things whenever you've made a mistake. You discard the page that has an error on it and you use a new page. The knowledge that you're going to have to do that, I mean, how many of you really like writing and copying the same thing over and over and over again? The knowledge that you're going to have to do that, you see, if you make a blunder down here on this line, you're going to have to go back and rewrite all of that very carefully and tediously once again. Knowing that that's the rule is going to tend to make you tremendously careful about how you copy things letter by letter by letter. Along with that, the fact that they were so very strict about not accepting any mistakes within the text, you also have, and you can only see that there are some marks over here and there are some marks over here, and you can see that there are some notes up on top and some notes on the bottom. And those marks and notes have to do with the rules, the Masoreth, because each line of text was assigned numbers based on the number of words in the line, the number of spaces in the line, the number of letters in the line, and what you would get if you totaled up the numerical values of those letters. And you have similar rules relating to the way the page is stacked, the way all kinds of minutiae of detail about exactly what's supposed to be on the page that acts as a counter check along the lines of a spell checker and grammar checker, but somewhat more mathematically determined than that, so that when you've done with that page, you double check by checking all of your sums, checking all of your alignments and totals to make sure that what you have is exactly right. Now, that system was put in place by these people who came to be known as the Masoretes because they followed the Masoreth. Another thing that the Masoretes did is they introduced little marks, and I don't think you can see them from where you are, but underneath all these words are little marks, and those little marks stood for vowels. Because in the original Hebrew writing, all you had was consonants. There were no vowels in the text. And up until about the 6th century, there was no standardized way of noting vowels in the Hebrew text. And I just wanted to take a minute for you to think about that. I've written two letters on the board, and I know you're going to look at those two letters, and the word that's going to come to your mind is doctor, but that's not it. Okay, that's not the word. This is two consonants that are intended to tell me what the word is. Now, what's the word? It's not an abbreviation.
Ador.
What is it?
Ador.
Door?
Ador.
Ador. Oh, not a door. A door. Dire. Deer. Which kind of deer? Okay. That's enough. You got the idea. Those two letters could be a lot of things, couldn't they? There's a lot of possibilities there. But what if I give you a little bit more of a context? Close the door. Most of the other possibilities become nonsense and don't even come into your mind when you look at that. And that's the way it is with the Hebrew language, with the Hebrew text. Most of the possibilities for ambiguity are just immediately eliminated by the context, and you don't even have to wonder what the original was. Most, but not all. Sometimes there is more than one possibility that makes sense. And the Masoretes, in putting the vowel markings into the text, had to make decisions in some cases about the ambiguities. And so there's a question here, because they are scholars, not prophets, of whether they always resolve the ambiguities in the correct way. That's one thing to be concerned about. There's another thing to think about in terms of this Masoretic text. The picture that's here on the wall is a picture from the Leningrad Codex, also known as the St. Petersburg Codex, because Leningrad and St. Petersburg are the same place, depending on the ruling regime in Russia at the time. This is a picture of a page from the Leningrad Codex, which is the best existing copy of the Old Testament in Hebrew. Now, there is another copy of the Old Testament in Hebrew that is just slightly older, just a few years older, called the Aleppo Codex. And the Aleppo Codex was considered to be sort of the crown jewel of Hebrew Bibles. It was in a synagogue in Syria. And during some rioting there a generation ago, the synagogue in Syria, the anti-Jewish sentiment was running high, and the synagogue was set on fire. And it was believed that the Aleppo Codex, which dates from the 10th century and was considered the finest manuscript of the Hebrew Bible in existence, it was believed that it was destroyed in the fire. Well, actually, there was a fair amount of James Bond-type stuff going on in connection with that, and the Israeli secret police were able to get a hold of that and were able to sneak it out of Syria. And after a few years had gone by, it turned up in Jerusalem, not in perfect condition. Several pages of the front and the back were, in fact, lost, fire damage, destroyed. But the bulk of the manuscript is still intact. But it's no longer a complete manuscript. The oldest complete manuscript of the Hebrew Bible with the Masoretic text, the text that has the rules of the Masoretes, is this Leningrad Codex, which is in a museum in Leningrad, or St. Petersburg in Russia. Now, just about 2 years ago, a man named Bruce Zuckerman from Claremont went and made a brand new photographic copy of the Leningrad Codex, and that has since been published in a color photo facsimile. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Had an opportunity to buy one when I went to a seminar where he was presenting information about that, and they had these nice facsimile editions there, and my recollection is the price was right about $500 for the color photo facsimile, and I declined to buy one because, I don't read that too well, as a matter of fact, and I didn't have a lot of personal use for a color photo facsimile copy. But this is a beautiful manuscript, and it's got beautiful color work in the front, which is in the opposite end of what you would think of as the front, and it's a very, very nicely done, and it's a very, very important testimony to the Hebrew Scriptures. But one of the things that we said yesterday is that it's best to have something that's as close as possible to the original writing or the original event. This dates from the 10th century. So this is 1,000 years old. But Moses' writings date from the 15th century B.C., 2,500 years before this. The last books of the Old Testament date to the 5th century B.C., 1,400 years before this. That's a long time in between. And so the question comes up, how can we be sure that this is really right, that this is really what Amos the prophet wrote, Isaiah the prophet wrote, Moses wrote in the law? A long time has gone by in between. How many copying errors have crept into the text in the meantime? How many times has the text been corrupted and then that corruption passed on? How good is it? Well, about the only thing that could be done prior to this century was to compare it to the Greek and the Latin that had been passed down. And that's very important to be able to do that. But there was no Hebrew manuscript older than the 10th century that we could look at until 1947. And that's where we're going to now go and talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. You've already seen a picture of this scroll. This is a scroll, a copy of the book of Isaiah. It's in just about as good a condition as that Leningrad Codex that we were looking at there. It's not particularly harder to read this than it is to read that. If you can read the one, you can read the other, because they're both written in the same kind of Hebrew script. They're both perfectly legible. There's no problem at all reading this one if you could read that one. If you can't read that one, you can't read this one either. So here we sit. But we have this Leningrad Codex from the 10th century, and now we have this scroll of Isaiah. And the date of this scroll, as is indicated on the screen here, is the 2nd century B.C. That scroll was copied down about 150 B.C. That makes it a full 1,000 years older than the Leningrad Codex and the Aleppo Codex. A full 1,000 years older than those two previously existing manuscripts. Now, the way this came to light is that we had, we had these Bedouins, okay? Now, what's a Bedouin? Okay, a nomadic tribesman lives in the Middle Eastern area. Okay, we had some Bedouin, some of these nomadic tribesmen who run herds of sheep and goats out in the waste areas, and they were running their goats down in the area of the Dead Sea. Just about a mile above the Dead Sea is where this particular manuscript turned up. It was 1947, a couple young fellows out looking after their flock, and one of them was trying to find a goat that had gotten separated from the others, and he was going up into the plateaus and the crags there, the rough area up above the Dead Sea, and he noticed a hole in the ground. And he had a sort of an ambition to get rich by finding buried treasure, and if you lived in and around the land of Israel, at least the possibility of finding buried treasure you'd think would be some sense there, because old stuff does turn up, you know, lost stuff that's been hidden for a long time. And he sort of fancied himself a bit of a treasure hunter, and so when he saw this hole in the ground, as he had done other times, other places, he took a rock and pitched it in just to see what would happen, because it was dark in there. And he heard something break when he threw it in, and he thought, ah, this may be the big chance. So when he went back to camp that night, he went back with a full expectation that he would go first thing in the morning and see what was in that hole in the ground. And he did. And his cousin went along with him. The two of them went into this cave, into this hole. See, a piece of the roof had fallen in, and that was the hole that they had seen, the hole that they went down into. And they were very disappointed when they got inside, because all they found were some clay jars, and when they opened the clay jars, the only thing in them was some old scrolls wrapped in leather. And they figured, well, that's pretty much a waste of time, somebody's old junk, and there was nothing of any value there. So they gathered up the scrolls, there were seven of them, and they took them back to their camp. And some of the other people in the group looked at them, and again, they thought, well, pretty much just a waste of time. And I understand that for several days they were just left hanging on a tent peg, on a tent pole, hanging there out in the weather, because they didn't think they had anything. But eventually they found their way to Jerusalem, and they were offered to an antiquities dealer to see if he would buy them. And the antiquities dealer looked at this scroll of Isaiah, and he said, well, obviously this isn't old. You probably robbed a synagogue. And he wasn't interested in what they had to offer. And it took quite a few approaches and rumors beginning to circulate before someone with serious scholarly credentials was interested enough to make an appointment and to have a look at it and to try and control himself enough not to let on the idea that this was hugely important and tremendously valuable. The oldest known copy of the book of Isaiah in the Hebrew language, a full 1,000 years older than anything known in our day and time. And so once this had happened, and once subsequent finds took place, as I said, there were seven scrolls that turned up in that first cave there of the Dead Sea, up above the ruins of Qumran, Kirbet Qumran, as it's known. As soon as that had taken place, there was a tremendous interest, on the one hand, to find out where they came from. And so after a lot of sleuthing and a lot of pressure and a lot of effort on the part of the authorities, they finally were able to get from the Bedouins the information about where the scrolls had originated. And they went and they excavated and they figured, well, you know, if there were scrolls in this cave, maybe there are scrolls in other caves too. And so all the scholars, the archaeologists that were involved in this, started looking in the other caves in the area. And there are a lot of caves in the area, something like 270 caves in the immediate area there. And they started going through the caves. And what they came up with was pretty much zip. They just didn't find anything. And so they kind of gave up for a while. A couple years went by, and all of a sudden, we started having little fragments of scrolls turning up on the market once again. Not in nearly as good a condition as the scrolls that had first been found, the ones that had been in the clay jars. And I will give you as a reference, although I won't turn and read it right now, Jeremiah chapter 32, verses 13 and 14. Jeremiah 32, verses 13 and 14, there is a passage here where Jeremiah is in Jerusalem, and the city of Jerusalem is under siege by the armies of Nebuchadnezzar. And Jeremiah has been saying all along, Nebuchadnezzar is going to win. And the best thing that we could possibly do is to surrender, because this is God's will. Yield to God's will. Surrender to Nebuchadnezzar. Don't fight this thing. And the people, of course, didn't want to listen to that. They regarded Jeremiah as a traitor. They put him in captivity. He endured all kinds of abuse. But here we are, winding down to the final days of the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. It's about 586 B.C. Jeremiah knows it's just about all over. Jerusalem is not going to go peacefully into captivity. The city is going to be destroyed. The temple is going to be destroyed. Jeremiah knows these things. He has said these things repeatedly and gotten in trouble for them again and again. God has given him the message that the captivity is going to last for 70 years. Well, now God gives Jeremiah a message in Jeremiah 32, and the message is, one of your relatives is going to come to visit you. And Jeremiah is a captive at this point in time. He doesn't have real freedom. But he is going to have a visit from one of his relatives, and his relative wants money. Everything is in tight supply in Jerusalem. And his relative is going to come into the city, and he is going to offer Jeremiah a piece of land that belongs to their family. He's going to say, Jeremiah, if you'll give me this money, I'll transfer the land to you. Now, Jeremiah thinks about that, and he says, that's ridiculous. Why would I buy a piece of land with the armies of Babylon sitting on it right now? Why buy it? What's the point? The Lord says, Jeremiah, buy the land, because land will be bought and sold here again. Crops will be raised and harvested here again. People will build houses here again. So Jeremiah is to make an investment in the future. He's to give an expression of hope that God indeed will bring the people back to the land in the 70 years, as he has said. And so Jeremiah is to buy the land, and he does. And Jeremiah is then instructed to take the deed, the two deeds for the land, the open copy, which is subject to examination by anyone, and a sealed copy, which is an official public record only to be referred to in case there is some question about the legality of the purchase. He's to take the two copies of the deed, which have been written and witnessed by Baruch the scribe, a name that we'll talk about again later, and he is to put them in a clay jar and to seal the jar so that they will last a long time. Well, the seven scrolls in Dead Sea Cave number one were in clay jars, and they lasted a long time. Not 70 years, but 2,000 years. Because when we talk about that Isaiah scroll, we are talking about a scroll of the Hebrew Bible that is in perfect readable condition, that is 2,000 years old, a little more than 2,000 years old. But in cave number four, and they didn't call it cave four yet, but in cave number four, the Bedouins found a lot more than seven documents. They found something on the order of 800 documents. But these documents were not in clay jars. These documents had once been sitting on shelves in library fashion. And over either the passage of time or else the violence of the Romans, because this community stopped being occupied in 68 AD when the Romans conquered that section of Judea during their war to suppress the Jewish rebellion. This place was defeated. All the male inhabitants were either killed or removed in 68 AD. Possibly the Romans actually got into this cave and damaged the scrolls. Some scholars think so. Either that or just the passage of time. The shelves, one way or another, fell down. The scrolls tumbled all over one another. And just in either purposeful damage or the passing of time, with deterioration and with the circumstances of having bats in the cave contributing to it somewhat, they got to be in a very, very poor condition, to say the least. A very, very poor condition. That was somewhat complicated by the fact that when these pieces began to show up on the market, the people who were in a position to want them very badly made an offer to buy them based on the size of the pieces. Now, that was a mistake, because what they said is they would pay a certain amount. I don't remember the amount at the moment. They said, we'll pay $2 for every square centimeter of this scroll material. Now, can you imagine exactly how that translated into the minds and actions of the Bedouins who were harvesting these tidbits from the caves? The more square centimeters we have, the more money we make, right? So if I have a piece that's 3 centimeters by 3 centimeters, I can make 9 pieces out of that and get paid for all 9 of them. Okay? And it took a lot of backpedaling and explaining on the part of those who were trying to buy them to say, no, we really want them in one piece, and we'll pay you just as much for the whole piece as we would for each part of the piece if you break it up and sell it to us in individual gibbles. So that was one of the problems they had to overcome. Time and again in the stories associated with the Dead Sea Scrolls, though, the people who knew the land, the Bedouins who lived there, outsmarted or outfoxed in one way or another those people who wanted very badly to be in control of these items, these artifacts, these finds that were there. They were first found in 1947, the first cave, the seven scrolls there. In about 1954 was when the last significant Dead Sea Scroll find turned up in the caves around the Dead Sea there. Although other excavations were stimulated, including the excavation at Masada that was done by Yigal Yadin. He did that largely because of what had turned up in the excavations of the Dead Sea Scrolls caves. And so there was a lot of other follow-up archaeological activity that took place after these finds. One correction I do want to make, at least I think it's a correction, I have here hundreds of thousands of pieces, and I actually saw a number a few days ago after this was already put down on paper and in PowerPoint, and the number gave an estimate not of hundreds of thousands, so strike that, but of 40,000 pieces, and I actually like that number better because it's a little bit more graspable as a number, of 40,000 pieces coming from some 800 documents that were found there in Cave 4. What you see here are pieces that come from the Book of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes fragments from Cave 4. Now that may not look like a whole lot, but that's actually very, very important. Because in the 19th century, and they were the heirs of the 18th century, and we are the heirs of the 19th century, and these things kind of build and get worse and worse as time goes by. In the 19th century, critical scholars looking at the Bible came to a lot of conclusions that are just plain baloney, but you have to be able to show that they're baloney in order to get them discarded and discredited. And one of the conclusions that they came to was that the Book of Ecclesiastes was probably written in the 2nd century B.C. Now, who wrote the Book of Ecclesiastes? Solomon. When did Solomon live? Okay, the 10th century B.C. There's a big gap from the 10th century to the 2nd century, but the scholars look at Ecclesiastes and say, yeah, well, the style and this and that and the other thing, it probably was written in about the 2nd century B.C. Now, already there was a problem with that because it's in the Septuagint version, which was translated about 250 B.C., and that's an important testimony. But there's another problem with that, a really big problem with that, in that this scroll is dated to 168 B.C., which means that this scroll that was in use in Qumran is as old or older as when a lot of those scholars were saying the book was probably originally written down. Well, nobody thinks that it was originally written down in Qumran. That's absurd. No one thinks that. This is clearly a copy of a scroll that has been in use for a long time. And in fact, there wasn't one but two copies of the Book of Ecclesiastes found among those documents there in Qumran. So that speaks very well to the antiquity of the text of Ecclesiastes. There are a lot of other things that speak well to the antiquity of that text as well that we won't go into in any detail. But this is one of the things that the scrolls at Qumran do for us, is that they push back to where I already think it should be, the evidence for the fact that the Old Testament documents were written in the time when they purport themselves to have been written, and that they were accepted as authoritative by Jews in the 2nd and 1st centuries B.C. in times when a lot of scholars were saying these things were just being written and put down. That's true not only of Ecclesiastes, it's true of the Book of Daniel. The Book of Daniel was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, a copy that relates to at least the middle of the 2nd century B.C. And that Book of Daniel, again, is a document that, according to the critical scholars, shouldn't have been where it was, because they look at what Daniel says, and Daniel talks about things that clearly relate to the Maccabean period in the history of Judah, when we have this Maccabean kingdom and we have the battle going on with the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and all the things going on relating to Syria and Egypt. And the critics look at that and say, well, obviously Daniel could not have written that until it had taken place, right? And so if he wrote it as a commentary on his times, then he must have written it in about the middle of the 2nd century B.C., because that's when these things were taking place. That's when they were dealing with Antiochus Epiphanes and all that. So when you find a copy of the Book of Daniel, which has the same linguistic peculiarities, that is to say, a big piece of it is written in the Aramaic language, and there's a break that comes in a particular place from Hebrew to Aramaic, and some other oddities in the way the language of Daniel is presented to us, and you find a copy of the book of Daniel that displays those same linguistic peculiarities that you have in the Masoretic text, and it dates to about the middle of the second century BC, try and get these numbers in the right places, then that again kind of throws that whole idea out of the water, that Daniel was just written down at that point in time. Daniel was already accepted as authoritative in the time that is being prophetically described there. It's already dispersed and in use by those people who are readers of the Bible, and they have commentaries dealing with it, and they discuss it and refer to it in the sectarian writings that they have there, and so on and so forth. Yes? There are a number of ways that they date the scrolls. One of the evidences that is used in dating the scrolls is the other materials that are found in the caves. And there are coins that have come out of those caves that go back to the time of Alexander the Great, which is older than they say any of the scrolls are, 325 BC. Some of the coins go back to 325 BC. So that's one of the kinds of evidence they use, is what's the other material evidence in the cave. They look at the writing on the scrolls, because styles of writing change. Now, I have no problem with that kind of evidence, because I have letters in my possession that were written by some of my immediate ancestors at the turn of the century, and I have copies of documents that were handwritten in the generation before that, and I can see the stylistic changes myself that have taken place in the last 100 years of handwriting in our own culture. And you can do a lot with paleography, and these things have been hotly contested, and the dates that I'm giving are pretty secure dates, pretty very confidently given by people who really don't like those dates at all. Okay. And the hostility of the source is one of the guarantees that there's a pretty high degree of confidence in this dating. But the materials, looking at the materials, and also carbon-14 dating has been a factor. They have taken pieces of these scrolls, and I view carbon-14 dating with a significant degree of hesitancy, because there are a lot of uncertainties when you get, especially when you get beyond a pretty narrow window of dates that you can deal with in carbon-14 dating. But there are a number of testimonies that speak to the dates that are assigned to these various scrolls, including the writing style, including the material that they're made of, including the carbon dating, including the surrounding material evidence that is present there in the caves. And we know, or I guess we know, we seem to know, that the community at Qumran, which is right here by the Dead Sea, Jericho would be right up here, and the proportions are not exactly right on this little hand-drawn sketch, but we know that the community of Qumran was occupied from about 140 BC to 68 AD. The buildings that are there in Kirbet Qumran, in fact, I have that information right here if I just think to put it up. The first buildings that are there in the remains that exist today were built in about 140 BC, and the destruction of Qumran took place very definitely in 68 AD. You don't have to wonder very much about that date, because there are records, there are historical records that deal with that event when the Romans came and overran Qumran. The occupation there was apparently, and I say apparently or probably, a group of Jewish cultists named or referred to as Essenes. Josephus refers to a group called Essenes. And at least some of the practices that are described in the documents from Qumran dovetail with what Josephus says. But it's not a perfect alignment, and so there is argument and discussion about whether the Essenes are really the right identification. Now, there's nothing in the documents that says we are the Essenes. I don't know if they called themselves that. That's what Josephus called them. But at any rate, we do know several things because of the documents that were there, including several among the original seven, the temple scroll and the war scroll and the community rule, what some of their basic teachings were, what their beliefs were. And that's also rather important to understand some of the things about who those people were, because they were living in the same time that some of the events in the New Testament were taking place. There's an overlap of the occupation of Qumran and the events that take place in the New Testament, the ministry of Jesus and John the Baptist and the establishing of the church, and references to the final destruction of Jerusalem and that way of life that would come by the hand of the Romans. And one of the things that is, again, very good about the Dead Sea Scrolls is that when we look at them, we find a world that is very much like the world that is described in the New Testament. Now, these documents are kind of securely dated. I mean, no one looks at these when these places were destroyed in 68 AD. No one looks at the temple scroll or the community rule and says, well, these were probably actually put in their final form in the second or third century or whatever else it may be, because they weren't there. The people weren't there. This is a kind of a closed episode historically. It has to fit within certain parameters. And so when you look at the writings of these people, and I'm going to call them Essenes because that's the easiest thing to do. When you look at the writings of the Essenes that are there among the documents at the Dead Sea in these caves, and they talk about the coming of the Messiah, and they talk about the coming of a prophet and of the king and of the one who would come as Elijah. When I talk about the kinds of things that we see people were in very strong argumentative discussion about in the New Testament, we see that the kind of ferment that's pictured in the New Testament that was going on in and around Jerusalem and Judea is the very kind of ferment that these people were dealing with in their writings. That is an accurate picture of the way Judaism was in the first century. That what we have in the New Testament dovetails exactly with what we can see from these non-biblical materials at Qumran. The kinds of controversies they had are the kinds of controversies we read about in the New Testament. The kinds of issues that they were wrestling with. The messianic expectation, thinking that with this Roman occupation, surely the Messiah is going to come at any moment, is present there in the Dead Sea Scrolls and, again, vindicates the account that we have in the New Testament, that it is an accurate description of the way things really were at the times when these things were taking place. So a few miles south of Jericho, southeast of Jerusalem, on a plateau above the Dead Sea, we have this community. Kirbet Qumran is called today. The word Kirbet means ruin. It wasn't called Kirbet Qumran then. We have this community of people who have a particular attitude toward themselves. They considered themselves to be the voice of one crying in the wilderness, a voice in the desert. Now, who do we consider to be a voice in the desert? John the Baptist. But the fact that they thought of themselves that way tells us that people were looking at those prophecies with an expectation of fulfillment. They thought that the King of Righteousness would come in. They believed that they were about to see the Messianic Age unfold. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why they joined in the rebellion in the late 60s, is because they thought this will be the catalyst for the Messianic Age. They had come to the conclusion that fighting the Romans was the only thing that would push the hand of God into acting in their behalf. And so they sacrificed themselves on that altar in vain, because the Messiah had come. God had kept his promises. He had done exactly what he said he would do. But they looked at those passages in the scriptures, and they were wrestling with the same prophetic passages that we see reflected again and again in the New Testament, that we are told were pointing to Jesus Christ. And they were trying to figure out how these things were going to unfold. And they were applying some of them to themselves, and some of them, of course, to the hierarchy that existed in Jerusalem, and to the circumstances of the lives that they were trying to deal with. Qumran existed in a very remote and desolate area. I know with the lighting in here, you probably can't see real well here, but these are the ruins of Qumran, and you can see it sitting on this dry plateau with the hills rising up behind it. And here is a valley, a wadi, which is called the Wadi Qumran. It's a dry stream bed. That is, it's dry most of the year. But now and then, when you have rains, you have water flowing in that, and that's what makes it a wadi. And that's Wadi Qumran, which is why they call that place Qumran. Well, in the hills up behind this, there's a place where the inhabitants of this area had built a little dam, and where they would block the flow of water and collect that water for future use, because, again, this is a very difficult and desolate area to live in. Now, this is a diagram of the floor plan of the settlement that existed there 2,000 years ago, before the Romans overran it and killed the inhabitants there. There's just a couple of things about this settlement that I wanted to point out to you. One of them is that the people didn't live there. It was a settlement only in the sense that this was the center of their activity. The people did not live there. There are no houses, no living quarters in this diagram. They haven't found any in those ruins. It was not a place to live. I already said that there are some 270 caves in the immediate area there, and the best indications are that the people who gathered in this place were people who lived in those caves, although there may have also been other accommodations, tents and things like that, that don't leave really a lasting impression. But the best indication is that they probably lived in the caves and gathered in this facility that they had constructed for themselves. There was an aqueduct I mentioned that brought water down from a small lake that they had created up on the hillside there, where they would collect the waters from the rains that would come. And that aqueduct brought the water down into here, and there was, it doesn't show on this drawing, but I have had a different drawing I looked at that showed a little bridge across here. And here was an area that you could get into by steps where some of that water was collected. And then the water would flow on down here, and here was another area with some steps you could go into. And over here was a larger water storage cistern, and here was another one that you could get into with steps. Down here we had another collecting basin, over here another one. Over here was one with some steps. Down here there was a collecting area, a settling pond, and there was a settling pond up here too where any dirt collected would settle out. And then over here, it doesn't show on this drawing, but there was another of the small water areas that had steps. And I point all that out to bring to your mind the fact that when John the Baptist was out doing his thing in the Jordan River, people came to him and said, "Why are you baptizing?" But they didn't come to him and say, "What's with baptism?" And there's a reason for that, because in the Judaism of the first century B.C. and A.D., baptism had become a commonplace ritual. It was something that they had drawn from the laws of ceremonial cleanness and purity, and baptism was a ritual that they well identified with and understood. John did not have to explain, "This is what I mean by baptism," because this is something that was practiced not just as a single life event in Qumran, but it's something that would be done at various intervals for personal purification. Now, part of the requirements for becoming a member of the community was that you be baptized. You had to be baptized to become a member of the Qumran community. But that's only one of a long list of things you had to do to become a member of the Qumran community. John the Baptist's list was a whole lot shorter than the list that they had at Qumran. John the Baptist didn't say that you had to give up all your worldly goods to the community, for example, as they did at Qumran. And John the Baptist didn't say that you had to be on a sort of a, what do you call that kind of program where you might get kicked out, a probationary period for 3 years, and a lot of these kinds of things that the folks at Qumran said. They were running a little different kind of an establishment than the one John and Jesus were working toward. But baptism was an ordinary part of their expectation of what it took to become a member of the community and to be clean before God. This was not some sort of a bizarre new idea that came on the scene with Jesus and John the Baptist. There are several quickie images of Qumran here showing the area. I did want to show these steps. Maybe you can make out here a series of plaster steps. They go down into one of those mikvahs, one of those ritual bathing areas. Those same kinds of bathing areas were located around the Temple Mount. And there's very little doubt, at least in my mind, that when we read about the 3,000 being baptized in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, that they were baptized in places very much like that place there, ritual baths that were there for the sake of pilgrims coming to the temple. That's just about the only place they could have baptized that number of people, in Jerusalem, a city that doesn't have a whole lot of open flowing water available for that kind of use. But they had plenty of these ritual baptistries accessible to people who were coming on pilgrimage to the temple. Down at the bottom here, there is a portion of one of the seven scrolls that was in Cave 1 when those boys first went in there. And it's a commentary on the book of Habakkuk. And I want to mention that to you because there is a specific section of it that deals with Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 4. What does Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 4 say? "The just shall live by faith." Now that passage is quoted in the New Testament. It's a very important passage in the New Testament. Paul quotes it in Romans 1:17 for one place. He has said in Romans 1:16 that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, the Jew first, and also the Greek or the Gentile. And then he goes on and he says that righteousness is by faith or from faith to faith. And he says, as it's written, "The righteous shall live by faith, the just shall live by faith." Now Paul develops that theme very, very thoroughly in the book of Romans. And what Paul means by that is, the nation was a little bit different. They said, "The just shall live by faith." Now faith is doing the works of the law. Now, how would Paul have reacted to that? Well, see, Paul did react to that. He said the works of the law cannot save you because the law brings an awareness of sin. So Paul was totally diametrically opposed to some of the fundamental teaching that stood behind the community of Qumran. One of the reasons I mention that is because, again, this points out that what was a critical issue in the New Testament was a critical issue among the Jews. What Paul's talking about there, this was a much-discussed concept among the Jews. And it's one that he needed to address in writing Romans that deals with the problems between Jewish and Gentile believers. It's one that he needed to deal with in writing Galatians. It deals with those kinds of problems of trying to remake the church over into just an extension of the legal entity of Israel, the law of Moses. So Paul is dealing with what is very much an issue among those who are looking at the law and trying to, at the whole Old Testament, because Habakkuk is not the law, it's the prophets, but looking at these things and trying to understand them. And again, that lends itself to our realizing that what the New Testament is all about is exactly in the right place at the right time, talking about the right issues to the right people. It is exactly on target with saying the kinds of things that needed to be said. That cave that I was talking about, Cave 4, is visible right here. This is where the opening is that that young man threw the rock down into. And then there's another opening down here, and you'd think, well, somebody surely would have seen that great big cave opening and gone into it before that. But that great big cave opening wasn't there. When the archaeologists got into this cave, the only opening was the one in the ceiling. And they found it a little bit dark and dank and dusty and hard to work in there. And so they knocked out a couple of holes in the wall to give themselves some light and some air to be able to work in the cave. But the cave had been sealed previous to this, and only when a section of the roof fell in and made the opening up there did the cave become accessible. But that is the cave in which they found the great Isaiah scroll, as well as the six others, and then, or excuse me, no, the 800 different documents and all the fragments relating to them with the various books of the Bible and so forth. Not, I said that that was the one the boy went in first, but that was Cave 4, not Cave 1. Disregard the part about that being the one the boy went in first. Not true. This is Cave 4. This is the one that the Bedouins found with all of the scattered fragments and pieces in it. I do want us to think a little bit about what kind of a challenge those scholars faced in having all those fragments put into their hands. Can you tell me how many puzzles are represented on the screen here? Well, I'll tell you, because I know, because I had the originals in my hand, that two puzzles are represented on the screen here. But how could you tell that by looking at those pieces? Now, if you had the box, the cover with the picture on it of the original, then you might be able to identify what piece goes to what puzzle. But lacking that, you would have a very hard time telling, a very hard time but not impossible, telling which of those puzzles, pieces, came from the same puzzles and sorting them out. There are things that you could look at. If you had them actually in your hands, you'd be able to turn them over and look at the back, see what kind of coloring you have on the back. You'd be able to look at the thickness of the paper. You'd be able to compare the finish on the covering of the colors there. There'd be various things you could look at to try and determine how they should be grouped as far as the original puzzles that they were a part of. How do you identify those puzzle pieces? Well, it would help a lot if you were dealing with known documents. And in the case of about 200 of the scrolls that turned up in Cave 4, they were dealing with known documents. They were dealing with books of the Bible, known documents. And so when they looked at those pieces of the ones that were Bible books, they didn't have too much trouble sorting them out. When they looked at the pieces of one like this, which comes from a non-biblical work, which they have given the name the Words of Moses, it was a little more challenging. But you could look at the handwriting to decide if the same person had written it. You could look at the back to see if it seemed to have matching grain and so forth. You could look at the thickness of the parchment to see if it seemed to be the same piece of skin. And you could use those kinds of evidences to try and line up the pieces.